Welcome to Why So Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, you'll hear about an art installation being created at Art Street on the University of Dayton campus. It's called Bullet, Who Pulls the Trigger? You'll also hear about this year's LGBT Film Festival taking place in Dayton next week. We'll talk with Jonathan McNeil at the Neon Movies and talk to the director and one of the actors from the opening night feature. Up first, the U.S. government continues to operate under a partial shutdown after House Republicans push for a 2014 budget that defunds or delays the president's health reform law. The Senate has rejected any version of a bill that attempts to chip away at Obamacare. Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of federal workers are on unpaid furlough across the country. Nearly 9,000 of those are civilian workers at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Republican Congressman Mike Turner's district. WYSO's Lewis Wallace talked to Representative Turner about where he stands on the impasse.
So you've supported the budget bill that would defund Obamacare, and now we obviously have a government shutdown that's affecting nearly 9,000 Wright-Patt workers. What's your stance on the budget debate?
Well, I have supported fully funding the government. I have opposed the sequester that resulted in 12,000 people being furloughed at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and this government shutdown that has resulted in people being furloughed at Wright-Patt. Also, the president has signed a law that would have put everyone back to work at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. It called for all of those individuals who are either uniform or civilian who work for the armed forces to not be furloughed. The president signed that bill, and then the next day sent nearly 9,000 people from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base home. We've been in touch with the Department of Defense demanding that they put the people back to work, and also have written the president of the United States telling him that he needs to put in place the law that he has signed.
But to be clear, Congressman Turner, this bill that makes cuts to Obamacare as sort of a rider on the budget, you have supported that.
Absolutely. I believe that the president needs to negotiate on a number of things, including Obamacare, the budget, sequester. This is a much broader debate. The president is unwilling, both in the debt limit and in the budget, to have any negotiations whatsoever about sequestration, about the budget, about Obamacare, about the future of this country, and he needs to come to the table.
Some congressmen have said that they're going to be donating their pay during this time. Are you planning to do that?
I'm here at work, and I'm here at work to try to make certain that we get people back to work, both at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and for our country. This is a dispute that the president needs to begin to negotiate with Congress on and look at some serious proposals to solve this.
What do you think the best possible outcome is here?
I think the president's going to have to come to the table and say he's going to work with Congress on these issues. You know, we have Social Security and Medicare headed toward insolvency. We have some very troubling provisions of Obamacare that are going to have negative effects on our economy. We have sequestration that is hollowing out our military. We have budgetary deficits, still looking forward without anything to try to address, avoiding trillion-dollar deficits. We cannot continue to just generate this debt. But yet the president has not come to the table in any meaningful way in any of these and continues to say he will not negotiate with Congress. Well, that's what government is. Government is a dialogue. It's a debate. It's a process of determining what's for the best interest of the nation. That has to happen.
Congressman Turner, are you willing to drop Obamacare from this particular debate?
Well, it depends on what the ultimate plan is that comes forward from the president that Congress can rally around.
I mean, but there are scenarios in which you'd be willing to drop Obamacare from this particular debate?
It depends, again, on what the president's willing to come forward with. There currently is line in the sand that the White House has drawn saying that they'll not negotiate on anything. All of these issues have to be addressed, and they have to be addressed by the House and the Senate and the president having discussions and negotiating. Until then, I think you're going to see the government continue to be shut down and the president continuing to neglect the major issues that are going to affect our economy.
That was WYSO's Lewis Wallace talking with Republican Congressman Mike Turner of Ohio's 10th District. Turner has called on the Obama administration to extend furlough exemptions to all civilian workers through a law known as the Pay Our Military Act. After considering that proposal, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel announced Saturday that most of its 400,000 furloughed civilian workers could be allowed to return to their jobs in the next few days. And as the government shutdown continues, WYSO's Emily McCord reports its impact on the Dayton region could last years.
It certainly isn't good news in the short term. Nearly 9,000 civilian workers at the base are furloughed, and Michael Gessel with the Dayton Development Coalition says, to put that into perspective,
to have that size number of people who are thrown out of work would be the economic equivalent of, say, LexisNexis, Honda, and AK Steel if they closed down and let everybody off.
But the shutdown could affect the region's long-term growth, too. Like it or not, Gesell says Dayton's economy is reliant on the federal government, and the region uses Wright-Patt to attract businesses here.
And many companies will locate in Dayton because they want to be near that. They want to be near the purchasing power of the Air Force. And so a lot of our recruiting is tied around those claims. And if that luster diminishes, then so does the power of those recruiting tools.
Gesell says the severity of the impact will all depend on how long the shutdown continues. And with neither party in Congress budging, it's becoming more likely it could last several weeks. For WYSO, I'm Emily McCord.
This week, Art Street on the University of Dayton campus will present a three-part collaborative art installation titled Bullet, Who Pulls the Trigger? The installation is a multi-regional collaboration between Art Street, the South Chicago Art Center, and the Newtown Action Alliance. It features original art created by Newtown and Sandy Hook students in the aftermath of violent shootings there. The installation also features work created by nationally recognized Ohio artist James Pate and kids from the Dayton Early College Academy. Art Street director Brian LaDuca says the exhibit's intent is to challenge artists, educators, and youth to reflect, question, and create artwork based on personal journeys through gun violence. It's meant to stir conversation.
Nobody has a right answer right now. Everybody has an idea, but you know, in this world, it's so easy to criticize and critique and acknowledge negatively. We can do it on blogs and comment sections on Facebook and stuff. It's a lot more difficult and a little bit more creative. You have to be a little more creative to be able to try to think of ways that everybody's got a positive say-so on this. So, again, it's one of those things where everybody's got a conversation, everybody's got an opinion, and we just want to allow everybody an opportunity to talk and speak their voice on this matter.
You mentioned developing the curriculum for this program and the upcoming installation. Tell me a little bit about some of the challenges and how that has evolved.
Absolutely. It's been a real challenge because what we did was we created a six-week curriculum design with six workshops that would be allowed these students and these artists to ask questions about the bullet and what does it mean, and it allowed the artists who were driving the conversations to take it any way they want to, whether they want to look at the mental health issues, whether they want to look at social construct, whether they want to look at the politics, whether they want to look at education. It was an opportunity to look at a multi different dimensions of gun violence in America, violence in the school systems. You know, you're talking about generations of students who are growing up now, including these current college students who, for them, 9/11 has always been. This is the first cognitive generation. This is the first generation that has no cognitive remembrance of September 10th or prior. Their whole lives have been the fallout of 9/11, of our economic status, our war, school shootings, gun violence. It's not about a time before. It's always just been. And for them, it's important for us in this curriculum designs to acknowledge that. That when they wake up, they don't wake up and go, oh my gosh, I can't believe this might happen to me. It is just, I wake up and this is part of my threat. This is part of my being. This is just who they are. And it makes them a very special group of generations to come and go right now. And it's our job with something like a bullet curriculum to begin to actually talk about these things with options, with understandings of different perspectives, but also not just theoretically. Put it in practice. That's what the curriculum design is for. It's 3 weeks of conversation, of deep diving immersion into personal journey, personal experience, personal opinion, and then putting it to paper, putting it to sculpture, putting it anywhere, using the art as a tool to kind of sort of change the social consciousness, something that we kind of look at like this idea of what is radical creativity in today's world, and that's what we think this bullet exhibition, the curriculum, the training behind it, has really kind of embodied, this idea of radical creativity.
Look at the whole thing. Now, that little part that's off right there, it doesn't bother me too much, but you do have a marking right there.
For 6 weeks, artist James Pate has been working with kids from the Dayton Early College Academy. He tells us about their portion of the project.
We were just finishing up our process of doing a tile mural. So the tile is not actual tile, but it's paper, but it's a foot square. And each student would work on a foot square sheet of paper individually. And then we would place them together and they would form into a larger piece. We put together a preliminary drawing, which is based on a discussion that we had. where we was responding to the question, bullet, who pulled the trigger? And so we developed a preliminary drawing, us having a discussion about that question. And they concluded that we in society are the ones who pulled the trigger. And so we basically just developed a piece of artwork that just sort of explored who are we, the designers of this environment, this society, the designers of the things that causes destruction. And so we just tried to illustrate that.
Pate believes this experience is one that kids from DECA will carry with them throughout their lives. DECA student Keandria Robinson says being able to have input on the project's direction was appealing.
I'm really excited. I'm excited to be a part of something like this. I think it's great, and the fact that we can represent our school and Dayton and really give our opinion on how we feel about who pulls the trigger is very exciting for me.
And fellow DECA student Nyla Flowers says the art project has expanded her horizons.
And it helped me to realize that a lot of people aren't aware about the violence that goes on within the communities because most people are sheltered and they don't go out into the world and they don't watch the news and they don't see what's happening in our everyday world. So I feel like this is a form of awareness to get this out here so they can actually see what's going on.
Bullet, Who Pulls the Trigger is a multifaceted art installation, and there are other events taking place around the theme of gun violence, debates, and open forums. To see pictures and find out more about these events, visit the WISO Weekend page at wyso.org. The Dayton LGBT Film Festival continues to grow as one of the Midwest's premier LGBT events. Jonathan McNeil with the Neon Movies in downtown Dayton says this year's film selections once again include something for everyone.
We really kind of run the gamut. We hit each of the LGB and the T and, you know, have a lot of shorts in the mix as well. You know, first of all, I'm on the lookout for films around the country at film festivals when I'm able to travel. You know, whether it's the Toronto Film Festival or whether it's even as close as the Cleveland International Film Festival, I'm always kind of on the lookout. But even festivals I don't attend, we are looking into their lineup. We're thinking, you know, what's playing well, what are audiences responding to, and then we reach out to those directors or distributors and ask them if we can take a look at the work.
So you're not waiting for these movies to come to you, you're actually out looking for them.
That's right. So ours is more of a curatorial process. That said, we do accept submissions, and there are some films that we chose that were as a result of people submitting their films. And we've started to get a little bit more of a response from the submission process. We don't have any kind of open call. We don't have a without a box, which is something that filmmakers use to enter film festivals around the world. We don't have anything like that. We haven't put out a formal request for submissions, but filmmakers are coming to us just based on our reputation and having known other filmmakers who've had their work play here.
That's rather nice for you after 8 years of planning that you've now got people coming to you.
Right, and our reputation's pretty good. We've had some filmmakers. I ran into a filmmaker in Toronto this year at the Toronto Film Festival, and he had been to the festival last year here, and he said that, you know, of the 40 festivals that his film played in, this was really his best experience.
How are our ticket sales so far?
Dayton is really kind of known for being a last-minute kind of crowd, but our passes are almost sold out. So as of this interview, which is about a week before the festival, we only have a few left. So I'm guessing that those will be gone, but there still are single tickets for each show available. But tickets are really reasonably priced. If you do come for the opening night film, GBF, that gets you into the opening night party as well, which is at the CADC, which is just a block away at the corner of 4th and St. Clair.
What are your favorites this year? I know you went through the curation process with these films, but some personal picks.
I really love Reaching for the Moon. Has a lot of aesthetic qualities of film that I like. I think that audiences are going to respond to that a lot. And there are a couple of the shorts that I think are just really spectacular. I wish we could have brought more of the filmmakers to the festival this year.
Jonathan McNeil with Neon Movies, thanks so much.
Great, thank you. I appreciate your support.
The festival opens on Friday with a movie called GBF. The acronym stands for Gay Best Friend. This week I spoke with director Darren Stein about the movie's premise.
Well, the movie's about this high school kid who gets inadvertently outed and becomes the must-have accessory for the three click queens who sort of rule the school, which is a gay best friend or a GBF.
And how did this film come to you?
The writer, George North, he had read an article in Teen Vogue about the phenomenon of high school girls sort of wanting a GPF and how that had become a new sort of trend for girls in high school. And George North, he wrote a screenplay, inspired by the article, and then he entered it in a screenwriting competition at a film festival in L.A. called Outfest. And in that festival, they pair the writers with more established directors who they think might be a right fit with the material. And I was sent the script, and I loved it, and I called him and optioned it, told him I wanted to make it as a film.
So I think what makes often for a great comedy is kind of a counterbalance of more emotional scenes, and GBF certainly has its share of both. Michael J. Willett, who plays Tanner, Paul Iacono, who plays Brant, his friend in the movie, have some heartbreaking scenes together.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because the movie, it's about a relationship between two, boys in high school who happen to be gay, and it sort of delves into that sort of unknown terrain of, okay, well, are we friends? Are we boyfriends? We're both gay, but we're the only gays here. And there's sort of like that gray area of what gay kids experience in high school because of so few of them. So it was fun to sort of add that layer to a traditional teen comedy, where the gay character usually is bullied or he's the odd man out.
And will you get to visit Dayton during the LGBT Film Festival next week?
I am. I'm coming out. I've never been to Dayton, Ohio, and the head of the festival has been so kind to me, and I just felt like, it's a nice way to see the country. I was raised in Los Angeles, but I'm one of those Americans who's never done the cross-country trip, with my parents. And so now with all these film festivals that GBF's playing at, I'm able to see some places in the country I've never been to.
I've been speaking with Darren Stein, director of the new movie, GBF, which will be featured as part of the LGBT Film Festival in Dayton next week. Darren, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
24-year-old Michael J. Willett plays Tanner in GBF. He told me how the part came his way.
Well, I was asked to play the role at the L.A. Outfest reading. They did a reading of it, and I think that was in 2012. And the writer, George North, had seen me on United States of Terra and thought that I could be, like, a nicer version of my character, sort of the opposite of what I played on United States of Terra. And I felt like once I read it, it was just so, like, smart and funny. I keep saying that it was the movie that I would have wanted to see in high school. Tanner became like a best friend, like for me even, I was like, nobody else can play this character. It wasn't until it came time to audition for it. And you would think that it was kind of like mine for the taking. And yet I had to convince casting to really believe that I was this role. And I just felt like it was mine. And so it wasn't until my birthday that they told me and that I got it, and they're like, you'll be shooting on Saturday or something crazy like that. But yeah, it was fun, and I'm glad I got to do it because I felt like, and there's like a scene where I have at the prom where I'm like, I have that big speech, and I just knew the importance of this. Like, I keep saying it was like historically monumental, like these words that I got to say. And so I was like, I want to be the one to say it. And so I'm really happy I got to.
What are some of the standout moments for you in this film?
Oh, there are a lot, definitely. I watched the film a little differently than anyone else would watch the film just because I was a part of it. There's definitely scenes that are my favorite. One scene is really cool where Sasha and I are talking. We're in the bedroom and we're talking about what it's like to be friends, like she and I. And she kind of keeps putting me in this box that I'm like this bitchy gay, and Tanner's really not. He's like, so the bitchy you are, the more you'll like me. And I just feel like that whole scene is very poignant because Sasha's character brings up some things that are like, she says, you don't want to screw me like some guy, and you don't want to try to one-up me like some girl. Like it can be a completely pure and genuine relationship, and I think that hasn't really been explored before, at least not in film, and as far as I'm aware.
Mm-hmm. How did the movie stretch your abilities as an actor, and what did you take away from the experience?
Well, I definitely was excited and kind of overwhelmed to see that I was like on every page and almost every scene of the movie, and very excited. But I felt like it definitely got to play. I got to play a side that maybe I hadn't got to play before. Like when I was on United States of Terror, I was playing someone very like outlandish and outgoing, and Tanner's the very opposite of all of those things, and so it was nice to kind of explore a different side of myself and represent a kind of person who doesn't get seen very often. You know, like not every gay person has a natural affinity for hair and styling, you know, like there isn't, you know, those people are out there, and their story needs to be told as well. And you know, I think it's very important, and I'm happy to be a part of it.
Well, and so conversely, what do you think audiences will take away from the film, or what do you hope they take away?
I hope that everyone has a really good time and sees that we're taking these sort of taboo topics or uncomfortable things and talking about them in a very fun and light way, because it's not very serious. Like, these are not things that are like one community experiences. You know, these are things that everyone feels. You know, everyone kind of is living in the closet in high school, and you know, it's just a matter of time before you come out, and then everything's a little bit better.
I've been speaking with Michael J. Willett. He plays Tanner in the movie GBF, which will be featured in the LGBT Film Festival in Dayton next week. Michael, thanks so much for speaking with us, and good luck with everything.
Thank you.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Full interviews with Jonathan McNeil with The Neon, GBF director Darren Stein, and actor Michael J. Willett can be found online at WYSO.org. Coming up next on WISO Weekend, this week we begin a month-long series of readings from the faculty of this summer's Antioch Writers' Workshop with Jen Violi, a Pittsburgh native who's also lived in Dayton and is an Antioch Writers' Workshop alum. Here, Violi reads from her debut novel, Putting Makeup on Dead People, the story of a young woman named Donna.
The next afternoon, Uncle Lou plucks the lemon off of the edge of his water glass and puts it on his bread plate. "I'm not a damn girl," he says, shaking his head. And then to me, "So how many boyfriends do you have these days?" "None," I say. And before Uncle Lou can ask me any more questions that make me feel uncomfortable and awkward, as Uncle Lou is apt to do, I add, "So I have something to tell you two." Mom gets that look on her face like she's terrified I'll say I'm pregnant or something, which is pretty funny considering I still haven't even kissed anyone. She puts down her roll but keeps hold of her knife, a clump of butter smeared on its tip. "You're not knocked up, are you?" Uncle Lou asks, a little too loudly. And two middle-aged women in corduroy jumpers and cream-colored turtlenecks at a neighboring table turn to us, aghast. Maybe I look more promiscuous than I thought. "No, everyone," I say, "not pregnant. Thank God," Mom says, and makes the sign of the cross. We are at Vandermeer's, which is Uncle Lou's special event restaurant, and I guess that means my birthday is a special event. Aunt Irene was supposed to join us, but Uncle Lou says she wasn't feeling well. I think that's Aunt Irene's way of saying she can't stand Vandermeer's and doesn't get what Uncle Lou sees in it. Today, Uncle Lou sports an orange Hawaiian shirt and Kelly Green polyester pants, which he has identified as his lucky trousers, something I have zero desire to interpret. Possibly inspired by said lucky trousers, Uncle Lou winks at the turtlenecked women who quickly look down at their dinner rolls. Mom glares at Uncle Lou, who shrugs and leans back into the pink cushion on his faux wood chair. Taking in Vandermeer's decor, funeral home circa 1972, I hope I'll have some decorating input at Brighton Brothers or wherever I work, because seriously, the dim lights and the pastel floral drape patterns will have to go. I don't understand why a funeral home can't be brighter, you know? More of a place that doesn't make you want to kill yourself while you're burying someone you love. I fold my hands in my lap. I inhale and exhale. I'm going to mortuary school. "Is that with the birds?" Uncle Lou asks. "Dead people," I say. "Birds are aviary." "You're going to school with dead people?" Uncle Lou asks. "Why on earth would you do that?" I want to say it just feels right. But that doesn't seem like a good enough answer, not for him, and certainly not for Chapman's application essay questions. Absolutely not. Mom's lips are set in an even line, and a crease divides her forehead. She turns to me. Honey, you've already made your college plans. I can tell she's attempting not to raise her voice, and I know I'm about to raise mine. Our waiter saves us all for a moment. His name is Rocky, and he looks less like Rocky the fighter than Rocky the squirrel. You like Stallone? Uncle Lou asks. I'm sorry, Rocky says. Sly Stallone, Uncle Lou repeats, leaning in. Never heard of him, Rocky says. You're shitting me. Uncle Lou raises one thick white eyebrow. No, sir, Rocky takes a deep breath and, to our surprise, is shitting no one. He seems to be trying very hard not to let Uncle Lou get to him. Can I take your orders? We order lunch, and when Rocky exits, Mom says, Lou, that was rude. Well, Jesus, Martha, Uncle Lou says, what do kids watch these days? Mom ignores the question and turns to me. You've already been accepted to a wonderful school, and that's where you'll be going. But I don't want to go to that wonderful school. I never wanted to go there. Well, this is the first I've heard of it. Mom rips a piece off of her roll. Besides, it's too late to change your plans now. Says who? Says your mother. Mom rips a piece of roll off of the smaller piece she just tore off. I wonder if she might shred the whole thing. Lou, how's Sylvia since her foot surgery? Which is Mom's way of saying, we're done talking about this. You can't ignore me, I say. I'm right here. Right now, Mom says, we're talking about your aunt's surgery. You can participate or not. Your choice. I choose to not participate, which seems unfair, given that we're supposed to be celebrating my birthday. At dessert, I ask for a virgin mudslide instead of pie, and everyone looks at me like I'm some brand of nuts. That will be my dessert, I try to explain. You saw they have blueberry pie, Mom says. Yes, I say, but this will be fine. I smile at Rocky. You don't want some dessert with it? Uncle Lou repeats. I shake my head. She's a drinker, Rambo, Uncle Lou says to Rocky. Rocky nods solemnly, writes something else on his notepad, and walks away. Uncle Lou leans across the table and squints at my hand, resting next to the water glass. It's definitely hereditary, the way you sit with your index finger pointed out like that. Nikki did that all the time. I look down at my hand, at my pointy index finger like Dad's, and I wish he was here right now. Without looking up, I say, it's not too late to change my college plans. Mom sighs and says, Donna, I'm glad you found something you're excited about, believe me. But it can't be this. Her voice sounds soft and she smiles at me like she's sad. You're already so... She stops herself. I just don't think mortuary school is the best place for you. Under the table, I fold my hands together, pressing my fingers into the backs of them. UD is a good school and seems like such a happy place. Mom brushes crumbs off of the tablecloth. You'll make lots of friends and have good role models around. You don't think I'd find any friends or role models at mortuary school? That's not what I'm saying. I feel fluttery in my chest and my neck is getting hot. I want to yell, but my voice comes out quiet and low. What are you saying, then? I just think communications is a great major for you. You'll learn how to interact with all kinds of people, live ones. Virgin mudslide for the young lady. Rocky steps up to the table and distributes two blueberry pie slices and one chocolate drink that I wish was full of alcohol. I slurp the mudslide loudly on purpose through my straw. I glance at Rocky. Sorry, my mom doesn't usually take me out in public. I haven't learned how to interact with live people yet. Watch it. Mom stabs her fork into her pie. Enjoy your dessert, Rocky says, backing slowly away from the table. I watch purple juice bleed out of the pale pie crust. Like Mom's wounded it, I know how the pie feels. Dad would have thought this was a great idea. Mom lets her fork drop and it clanks against the plate. A few drops of juice splatter onto the white tablecloth. She grabs the edge of the table and doesn't look up. I know I shouldn't say anything else. I know I've already crossed some line and I can feel something like a lightning storm in the air, but I can't stop myself and I'm angry. I finally found a job I actually want to do and Mom wants to stop me. Dad would want me to do what I love. Mom looks up at me, eyes like steel. Well, your father isn't here. It's just me. I know, I say. And it's just me, too. We stare at each other, and I can almost hear thunder rumbling or someone whistling in a dusty old west town. Uncle Lou clears his throat. So how much does a mortuary school education go for these days? Lou, Mom says, releasing her grip on the table, Donna and I will finish this discussion later. She forces a smile, and the storm appears to be over for now.
More from the Antioch Writers' Workshop next week on WISO Weekend. You're listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org, a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenney. Coming up next, The Book Nook.